We had found out that he lied about this whole S4 thing, and he said that he was pressured into it by the people at IUFOC to include that in a story, because he talks about it in the original interview, and some people called him out on it. So I started distancing myself from him, because I was like, well, maybe some of this stuff's not real information, because we're not like, I don't find any solid evidence for this TR-3B craft. Or, you know, that they did much into these programs other than the Henry William Wallace patents back in the 70s, which would have been around the same time period, I guess. And maybe it there is a program, but we got the hint from some of the other people on the team that, you know, he was spreading disinformation. Ted Gunderson was, you know, he gives the names of the military contractor, the scientists involved, and, you know, those are the details that you need as whistleblowers to really blow the lid off programs. Opening up, you know, the scientific side of this, opening up a lot of that information, giving people access to the scientists and the information, and giving a platform for that to be done. And I think that that's my contribution anyway towards disclosure and towards, you know, the future.
Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coeus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coeus Institute.
I started making videos on Alien and Scientist channel in 2009 and talking about all kinds of stuff. And I met a lot of interesting people that contacted me when I started talking about this stuff and making videos about it. And people were like, hey, you know, I actually met a guy who knew Edgar Fouché, because I did a video on the TR-3B and the Riddle of the Skies stuff. And he introduced me to Ed Fouché, so I was able to get like a ton of inside information on, you know, Ed Fouché and his whole story and journey through all this. And
we called him out. Who's Ed Fouché for people that don't know?
So Edgar Fouché was a guy who worked at Area 51, and it's interesting. I interviewed T.D. Barnes later on. He was head of the Roadrunners organization. It's all the ex-employees of people who worked at Area 51. And he says that, you know, Bob Lazar didn't work there at all. But I asked him about Ed Fouché, and he took him a while to get back to me. But he said, I can neither confirm nor deny that he worked at Area 51, which is a completely different answer. And we have a lot of documentation. You know, he released his military records, showed he was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base. But apparently the Area 51 is a classified assignment out of Nellis if you're stationed at Nellis. So it's kind of like hard to track down the actual military people who work there and stuff. Just like, you know, they have their own flight terminal at I think it's McLaren Airport.
I forget. What's Ed Fouché famous for saying? What's he famous for claiming?
So he came out in 1998 at IUFOC, and Ed Fouché talked about metamaterials and quasicrystals, which are the things you need for invisibility and photonic circuits and stuff like that. And he also talked about hydrogen crystals, like solid hydrogen being used as this free energy source kind of thing, that's out there in the literature, and people are working on it now in the real world. But he was talking about a lot of this stuff back when it was still pretty much classified, which is, you know, that's documented and on the record that he was talking about that stuff in 98. And he's the first person also to talk about that TR-3B craft.
Right. Which
I'm not so sure about the TR-3B. We haven't found any like direct evidence for that.
Well, you're not so sure if it, you don't think it exists?
What I think might have been, right? There might have been a program. I think there was a program to research all that rotating Mercury, it sounds like an easy enough thing to do. I mean, the Nazis were apparently doing that with the Bell Project. So there's got to be like a secret project where they did that somewhere. We have the Henry William Wallace patents. He's a guy from Valley Forge, PA, worked for General Electric Corporation, which made, of all things, mercury vapor bulbs, you know, the lamps. So they would have been a perfect contractor or place to outsource a research project like that to, you know, a lab and industrial facilities already capable of handling large amounts of mercury. That would have been a good choice for that. So he's an interesting guy, and there's, I think, more that needs to be dug up there and told. But as far as TR-3B, well, there was a TR-3A that was the TR-3A Black Manta. So this was a whole predecessor program run by Teledyne Ryan Aeronautical Corporation out of San Diego. And in San Diego, if you go east, right above Mexicali, there's a town called Homestead, California. I think I don't know if it's Homestead, California now. I might have that mixed up. Let me just look it up on Google Maps real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
But this is the place where they developed these triangular craft, and there's a lot of sightings out in that desert area of triangle craft during that time period, which is interesting because this was the predecessor for the B-2, you know? And
well, this is what people think it could be, though, right? Like a classified spy platform, not necessarily alien.
El Centro, Texas. It had a super quiet engine on it, and it was a spy drone that could be flown by remote control up to a mile away, and it would report video back in like eight or I think they upgraded it to 16-bit video, but it was like basically a video game processor in it that would have a camera on this thing that would transmit the video signal back to them at home base, and they could fly it around.
Right.
This very low definition video camera, early digital video camera.
So you think that might be the kind of predecessor of later developments in triangle technology, or?
Well, not triangle technology goes back to the Nazis and the Horton brothers who started developing wing-shaped craft.
Right.
You know, we had YB-3 and a whole bunch of other designs too in the Air Force, but they were naturally resistant to radar because the radar equation for the return signal of EMF of a return signal for a radar is highly minimized if you don't have any vertical stabilizer or fuselage sections, because it's that wall that your radar bounces off of. So if it's just a wing, it's really hard to get a radar bounce off of that. So they're naturally like stealth aircraft. And then you have this whole facility in El Centro, Texas, where they were doing all this research into the early building drones to basically test these airframes, and then also the technology for, you know, early UAPs, UAVs, sorry, unmanned aerial vehicles.
Right. So do you think, this guy that was at Area 51, what was his name? The one that had the claims about the programs working on quasi crystals and
So this is Ed Fouché, and he actually got in touch with me through a guy who saw my YouTube videos and
right.
Me in touch with Ed, and so I did a number of interviews with Ed over the years, and then me and Ed got in a big fight, and this was before anyone knew I was Jeremy Riss. I was Alien Scientist, and he doxed me and put my real name out there.
Why did he do that?
Well, he was I don't know. We had a big falling out over this. We had found out that he lied about this whole S4 thing, and he said that he was pressured into it by the people at IUFOC to include that in his story, because he talks about it in the original interview, and some people called him out on it. So I started distancing myself from him because I was like, well, maybe some of this stuff's not real information, because we're not like, I don't find any solid evidence for this TR-3B craft, or, you know, that they did much into these programs other than the Henry William Wallace patents back in the 70s, which would have been around the same time period, I guess. And maybe it there is a program, but we got the hint from some of the other people on the team that, you know, he was spreading disinformation. And there was another guy on the team that, like, he accused of being the disinformation agent afterwards. And then everyone's accused that guy of being, you know, everyone's accusing everyone else of being disinformation. And the whole team just, like, fell apart. And we had a forum that was on my website. It was over the forum. It was really central to the forum that we had started. And there was a lot of people on that forum sharing a lot of real crazy information and stuff. And I was there trying to get threads started on important topics and stuff. And a lot of the threads were being hijacked with disinformation. You know, there was just, it looked like bot, or it looked like to me, I was like, the only way I can explain it is like, this had to be like the early generation of AI chatbots that they had set up a room full of these computers to just spam conspiracy forums. This was towards the end of forums as a medium, because, you know, people kind of fell off and stopped using forums kind of after that, because this happened to so many forums. It's a technique called forum sliding, and they would just develop AI bots to do this, and they'd come in and just dominate the forum with crap information and nonsense and other stuff. So it'd be impossible to just have a regular conversation or moderate it and to keep up with it either. So yeah, that was like I think one of the an interesting time in cyber warfare, intelligence warfare.
For sure. Well, so you don't think that guy's legit, dude, or do you think he's legit and maybe saying certain things that are disinformation?
Certain things were good, like certain sources. You know, with guys like this, Ed Fouché is not a physicist. He's not an educated person. He's a guy who was inside some programs as a military sergeant, working on the F-15 flight systems, and had access to some personnel and people. And he dug into some things, and he just reported what he found. Okay, so I mean, you do stuff like that, you're gonna find some information that's legit, and you're gonna, you know, and you're going to get thrown some red herrings and maybe some disinformation. So I think that it's possible that, you know, the TR3B stuff was, you know, woven together to throw him off the trail of was the TR3A program. Or maybe there was another program out there. I don't know. This is, I haven't, you know, gone to the facility and interviewed the people that worked out there. I assume they're all retired. I would love to be able to track them down and get the employee list from.
What about Bob Lazar? You think he's legit or not?
Well, we dug into Bob Lazar quite a bit too. And I used to think he was legit back in that time. And then Ed Fouché started, you know, making me question the story, you know, asking me like, well, this is not the ID badge that you know, we used to have. The ID badge should be issued by Wackenhut. Which is the security director, and they do electronic badging and security for out there. So, and then he'd have to have an EG&G, a contractor badge too, to identify him as a contractor rather than what I had, which was, you know, he said he had a U.S. Air Force badge, you know, like a separate one. So like he was able to fill in a lot of like details about the case that didn't make sense. Like, why does this thing say MJ-12? And then Bob admitted that, you know, it was a reproduction of what his ID badge looked like, had looked like, and not the actual ID badge itself. And then, you know, some of the other issues. So you know, we dug into Bob Lazar pretty early on, and Ed and several other people I've met through Ed introduced me to another guy, Dan Benker, who's in the deep in the whole John Lear camp. You know, so he knew John Lear very well and got a lot of information on inside information on the Bob Lazar case through John Lear, and just knew and just been doing this a long time before about UFOs. So he knew where to find certain key information in videos and stuff. And he was able to help out a lot with, the research into Bob. And if you get Dan Benkert on your show to talk about Bob Lazar, I mean, you know, it's like he knows more than anybody I think I've ever met who's publicly willing to talk about the case. I have met one person that knows stuff that Dan doesn't know, though, and might know, probably knows more about the case than Dan. And that's Gene Huff. So Gene Huff actually responded to a few of my emails I sent a year or two ago. And he's been, you know, open. And I had a phone conversation with him once. I got to get back in touch with him on a date. We can both catch each other. But he wants to come forward, but he wants to say that, you know, he believes Bob. He wants to defend, say, like, this is why I think Bob was telling the truth, and he wants to, you know, lay it down and stuff. So I'd like to hear, you know, I'm still open to the possibility, you know, that there's more untold, you know, information about this whole story. But so far with the Bob's information, it's just like the TR3B stuff. It's like, yeah, we have some stuff on torsion physics maybe, or, you know, plasma physics, MHD, you know, kind of, you know, Bob Lazar talked a little bit about MHD, claimed to have a PhD thesis. I mean, a master's degree, and his thesis was in magnetohydrodynamics, but can't produce the thesis and can't really, you know, present or speak any on it to prove that he knows the subject. So if you got a master's degree in something, you should be able to, like, come on APAC and give a presentation of, you know, what you studied and what you know. But Bob's, you know, presentations have been, you know, very lacking on the deep scientific knowledge basis. You know, the element 115 stuff, we know that Glenn Seaborg wrote an article in 1968 for Scientific American talking about the island of stability. This is in the public domain, public sources, and it was available knowledge back in like the 70s. And when I went to the school, I remember I used to look inside the chemistry book, and it used to have all those elements past, you know, the lanthanide series of like the higher elements, but it said not discovered yet, but we have estimates that these, you know, so it's just arithmetic that you add more protons, you get a higher atomic number, and you can go up and up and up and up, and then they just get less and less stable as you go.
Right, because his claim was that he was working with a stabilized version. Is that was the claim?
Yeah, his claim is that they got a stable version of this, and that it was so stable that they could machine it in their machine shops, and that they outsourced it to Los Alamos too, apparently, to do some of the machining and then shipped it back. I don't know why they would do that. It doesn't make sense, because the metallurgist for the Manhattan Project was Battelle, and that's, you know, one of the key contractors in the UFO file. So what made me start really questioning the story is that, you know, in addition to it, the fact that it's out there on Joe Rogan and in the mainstream media, you know, most people should be aware of the findings of the Church Committee back in the 70s, that the CIA controls everyone of any major significance in the mainstream media. And if you look back at the merger of the big six corporations that happened a number of years ago, we found that, like, you know, more and more of the media, the mainstream news that you're digesting and receiving every day is held in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And that is about as close to a description of the Illuminati as you could possibly get. But besides that, you know, you question why this stuff is so mainstream, why it's so popular. And it's a red herring, I believe, because Site 4 and S4, when it came out, Site 4, there was two places that were real called Site 4. If you know, Tonopah Test Range had a Site 4 which ran ECCM technologies, that's electronic countermeasures. So radar is an ECM, that's an electronic countermeasure. And if your radar is detecting stuff and you want to not be detected by the radar, you can use ECCMs to make flares, you know, project plasma balls with lasers that you can, you know, as chafe, a chafe is another word for this, where they'd have, like, basically the planes would fire off fireworks. Like, if you got missile lock on you and you're in an F-16 in a dogfight, you can chafe, and it sends out, the heat seeker will go after the white phosphorus and the chafe for the missile. So you can avoid a missile with some of these techniques. So this is like countermeasures. It's part of strategy in warfare. So some ECCM facility was basically a counter radar facility where they built the mock radar of the Russian radar, and they were trying to figure out how to be invisible to it or counter it. And that was called Site 4 at Tonopah. And apparently his friend Jim Tagliani worked there. So he would have had some source of inside information that it was a top secret facility called Site 4, and there was some crazy stuff going on there. And so maybe that was woven into his story. There was another Site 4 at Plant 42 in Palmdale, at where the B-2 bomber was being made. And that's a whole nother issue. The order, they gave him funding for like 200 B-2s, and I think they only produced like 26 or 28 of them at the end of the program, and the rest of the money is just gone into some black program somewhere. So it begs the question, if you have, you know, two top secret facilities called Site 4, why not a third? But, you know, the evidence we found so far for Papoose Lake being the location of that facility, first off, you know, doesn't have the guard shack. It doesn't have the chain link fence. We have satellite pictures going back to the 60s, so it never did. During, especially not in 89 or, you know, 88 when Bob claims he worked there. So, the Element 115 stuff came out of Bob, but it didn't come until October of 1989. He came out as Dennis in May 1989, but didn't come out with his full name or the whole science and the whole big story with that long form interview that he did in October of 1989. So also in May 1989, the Scientific American published another article on super heavy elements and the island of stability, talking about, you know, this prediction of a, you know, maybe a stable group around 114 and 115. So it's possible that he could have used that as a source for the information. It's a publicly available source and it fits the time period and the timeline of the story. You know, but as far as I'm aware, there's no classified information or no, you know, information that Bob's ever come out of, disclosures that he's ever made, that we can definitely, you know, 30 years later say, hey, we FOIA'd this, or we found the papers on this. There's nothing there. It's just, it's completely devoid. And I feel personally shafted for having wasted like 10, 15 years of my life researching the case to find out all this disappointing information. And then now when I try to bring that information out on podcasts like Concrete, getting so many haters and people calling me a disinformation agent and all sorts of things from people just for trying to share the information and the research.
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, like that's, I mean, it's the cult side of things, man. Like, you know, a lot of people just desperately want to believe in these things. I wanted to believe Bob Lazar. You know, I was super into it. I've paid more attention to you and to other people that have been highlighting things, and I'm sorry, but you can't ignore those discrepancies, man.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's been a difficult battle. I think it's the tide's turning hopefully soon, because a lot of people have done the research and are starting to research and realize, but you get guys that get completely burnt out and totally discouraged after they come to that conclusion. And it's like, no, that's not, and that's a big turnoff to them, to my channel, because they're like, oh, this guy's debunking my hero. And the guy that, you know, well, Bob's kind of my hero too, because I wouldn't have researched any of this stuff if it weren't for Bob. I wouldn't have gone down these rabbit holes and dug into the physics and found the real stuff. Like, and that's what people should be hopeful for, is that, you know, there are technologies like metamaterials and quasicrystals, and there's a photonic revolution going on with bridging the terahertz gap right now in our technology. And for the next generation, you know, they tell you the cell phones of the future are going to you're going to be able to wrap them around your wrists, and they're going to be clear, and they're going to run on sunlight and all this stuff. And these are the technologies that we have today to develop those for tomorrow. And so there's more opportunity today than there ever was. And just because Bob Lazar didn't turn out legit doesn't mean that there's not reverse engineering projects going on. It doesn't mean that there's not recovered UFO material somewhere that's being, you know, carefully hidden and stored away from, you know, the public and even the government's oversight and private corporations, you know, where the government cannot get a hold of that stuff. So there's all that going on, and it shouldn't. What I think is that there is a deeper thing, is that this is disinformation that's being recycled from 30 years ago. It was used to kind of deflect They had, I think that by 89, they had already, the cat was already out of the bag, I think 86, 87, about Area 51, you know. A lot of foreign intelligence agencies were aware of it, and it was published in a couple of low-key magazines, you know, discreetly, that you can go back and look up. I forget the name of the one, the first one that published it, but it goes back to 87, and Lear was into all this, and he was talking about it on the record with George Knapp a year before Bob Lazar, and so this was public knowledge, and I think I personally think that Bob was, you know, used to catapult this message out.
I was going to say, what if it was all about the fact that, okay, people are going to start to become aware of the existence of this place, so as a kind of national security smokescreen, we'll now put this narrative out that it's the place where we're hiding the flying saucers and the alien bodies, and that will create enough of a kind of noise around this area for them to be able to obfuscate what they're really doing. Which I think primarily was, you know, classified spy platform testing and things like that. But I mean, I agree with you that there's certainly no reason to discount the idea that these retrieval programs, these reengineering programs, don't exist just because there may be some issues with the Bob Lazar story. Because there are definitely other avenues through the history, if you do your research, where it's suggested that this is something that's taking place. What do you think about David Grush?
I don't know, because so Jeremy Corbell on this recent, he was recently on Joe Rogan, and Jeremy Corbell, Joe Rogan, and that David Grush came forward because of Jeremy Corbell, and that, you know, he's like essentially the guy that he met him at this thing and helped him come out and everything. So I went and texted Ross Coulthart to see what he had to say about that. You know, and because this is supposedly Ross's whistleblower, not Jeremy Corbell's. And, you know, he says he's full of shit. You know, Ross says Corbell's, you know, full of shit, you know. So I think Corbell, like, over, you know, inflates himself. Maybe he overinflates his own position in ufology and the things that he's done. I think that he's got a lot of his inside sources that he can't reveal or talk about. I'm pretty sure they're disinformation. And if you told us about them, we'd be able to, you know, verify those. And
yeah, well, I mean, I've worried about that. And I know a lot of my colleagues have worried about that as well, quietly in the background.
I think that he's, you know, he doesn't have a super strong background in UFO. I mean, how do you become a ufologist? So, you know, how do you become a UFO expert?
I think he's extremely eager to be, you know, giving this information out and speaking about it publicly, and he's very much pro transparency on the subject. But that doesn't mean that you can't be manipulated by people that are giving you information, and you might trust them a little too much just because of their backgrounds. And I do think that's a real worry. It's happened to me. I've had people reach out to me that I've later in life realized, you know, well, that person was full of shit. But at the time, I got all excited because they were giving me a kind of a background that appeals to you when you're doing this type of research. It happens to everyone. And I don't think Jeremy's beyond that either. Whether or not he would admit to it is another question, because they've brought up some pretty questionable cases over the last year or, you know, last 2 years that people have found issue with. And so, you know, are they being used as a way to disseminate disinformation, even if they're doing it unwillingly?
Exactly. And the CIA operates that way. They would rather use people that are vehicles that do it unwittingly. And that's the whole terminology, what they call a ACE officer versus an agent. You don't have to work for the CIA to be a CIA agent. All you have to do, people who work for the CIA are case officers. And what case officers do is they discover and manage agents through manipulative you know, sort of clandestine and discreet tactics. So it could be just befriending them under a false profile and be like, hey, Jeremy, I love what you're doing. Let me give you $10,000. Keep talking about this, and this, and I'll keep funding you.
Well, I mean, I don't know if he's receiving any sort of, you know, funding, but it's just, it's certainly easy to, if you're very eager and excited about a subject, it's very easy for someone to kind of get in there and manipulate the way that you talk to people, especially if you're a public persona. And I just think that people obviously recognize, if they're doing their research in this field, that it's decades of psychological operations and disinformation on this. It's been permeating the subject this entire time. to think that that stopped now would be really weird. It's obviously carrying on now. There's still going to be psychological warfare. It's going to be a little bit more sophisticated. And I just don't see how you could look at the narratives and the process that's unfolding in government right now and not imagine that there may be things happening in the background that you don't know about, and that it's all just squeaky clean. It's a nice transparent disclosure. They're trying their best to get, you know, information and answers.
That's the
there's just no way that this could be handled transparently by this structure.
So the thesis is, you know, now being presented as Jeremy Corbell and his evidence, where the antithesis is now the Congress responding to the UFO community, which isn't anybody else besides Jeremy Corbell. He's the only one, of course. And so we have to focus on everything that Jeremy Corbell's put out. Then they debunk all that. That's the antithesis. And the synthesis that they're hoping for is not disclosure. The synthesis that they're hoping for is actually where Congress will be so fed up with the subject and the bullshit red herrings they've been chasing for the past year that they're going to say, we're not going to look at this for another 70 years again. And it's going to...
So if that really was the process, who's the they in that scenario?
So that would be the intelligence agencies like the CIA that were set up after Roswell specifically for that purpose, you know, and with that goal and objective in mind, on the behalf of the banking and financial communities. So that the banking and financial interests work with the military industrial complex, you know, they work with the oil and gas and energy industry, the Atomic Energy Commission included in that. With other fuels, and they work with drugs and drug cartels. This is documented. So with gold, oil, and drugs, and God we trust, this is sort of the plan that's existed, the cancer that's existed on our society since Eisenhower warned us about it before he left office. Because there's so much other stuff that people need to realize that UFOs is connected to when you start really digging into it. And I went on Dark Horse podcast and debated Michael Shermer on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, that was great, by the way. Really great.
Thank you. And again, you know, my expert that I've been learning the JFK stuff from is Mark Grobert of America's Untold Stories. And so I suggested, hey, you know, Shermer said his expert's Gerald Posner, who wrote Case Closed, you know. So I said, why don't you get Gerald Posner on to debate with... you know, Mark Grobert, because that's my expert and his expert, you know, so like, we'll get those guys to come on and debate. That would be just strictly JFK, and that would be something to watch, huh? So, yeah, Mark Grobert's claim that he's going to, Gerald Posner claimed that he's going to release Case Closed with an added chapter to address all this stuff. Have you really looked into all the stuff that's come out in the last 30 years since you published your book? Because you're going to need a lot more than one chapter.
Right.
Yeah, this one is turning around. And as we look into JFK, we realize, what was the CIA doing in that, you know, that decade and a half from Roswell to JFK? And when you start filling in a lot of those holes, you start seeing, wow, they were like really out of control with... a lot of stuff. And, you know, when JFK found out about the Bay of Pigs and the Operation Northwoods.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is 1961 Operation Northwoods plan, which is very similar to 9/11. When he found out about those two plans, he kind of was like, he wanted to shut the CIA down. It was really going after him. He fired Dulles and he fired Cabell. And Cabell's brother was the mayor of Dallas, so Dallas was picked as the spot for all that, and the rest is history. You go to America's Untold Stories if you're interested in learning about that, because that guy has done his research.
Yeah, how much of it do you think any of it had anything to do with the UFO file? Because he was interested, and
Oswald was in New Orleans working for Guy Bannister for the Free Play for Cuba Committee, and
right.
at 554 Camp Street, New Orleans. That's Guy Bannister's office. Guy Bannister is the FBI agent who created the X-Files. Oswald is directly connected to the UFO file. It couldn't be more connected. In fact, that the same CIA unit that set this all up is the same one that's held on to these secrets. It's the same people that created the CIA in 47, you know, to cover up a lot of this stuff.
How deep do you think it really goes with the black technology, man? Like, if you really have your best assessment.
Yeah, we might have alien stuff that's been, we've been sitting on trying to figure out. We bring it out every decade to get a science. We'll pick like 12 scientists and get them to like have a peek at different parts of it and try to see what we can figure out from it. That's what I think. It's something like that. Honestly, it's gotta be something crazy like that. Cause where did a lot of these things come from? Yeah. You can say they had, you know, human origins and we tracked them down, but some of them like the quasi crystals thing, I still don't know. Daniel Scheckman did his postdoc at Wright-Patt, and then that's when he made the discovery of quasi crystals. So it's quite interesting that some of the connections that we might not know about still behind the scenes. Nitinol wire is another one that's always fascinated me. That why did we start doing all this research in titanium and shape retention alloys right after the Roswell craft? All those people were reporting that foil that did all that weird stuff.
What do you think of the Corso hypothesis? You know, that these things have been subtly integrated into society through innovations that we just think are human, but turns out there was some influence, you know?
I think it's... The research is still going on. I mean, I did a lot of research into some of the things for, you know, he's talked about, and I've traced back a lot of the human origins for a lot of things, you know, fiber optic cables, for example. The Romans knew that, you know, light would travel through the a water spout. Like, you poke a hole in the side of a barrel and let the water pour out, the light will travel inside that like a tube. So they knew it would, like, fiber optics, you know, total internal reflection was a thing inside of fiber optic cables and also water channels and stuff like that. So they understood that, you know, they understood, you know, so some of the stuff that he claimed I could trace down. But like I said, the nitinol wire was probably the one thing that he claimed that I was really, you know, I'm still kind of curious about, you know, what Naval Ordnance Labs knew about this technology and what they still might know. Curious that I asked Richard Doty whether he thought we should subpoena the head of Material Command and the head of, you know, Naval Ordnance Labs to testify about whether, before Congress, about whether or not they really have alien technology and hold on to this stuff. Because that's kind of was the angle I was taking. And Doty's like, oh, that's not going to do anything, and they shouldn't have those people testify. Which I don't know. That I'm still skeptical of Doty. I don't know what to make of him, man. He's an interesting character, man. And you know, he was with the Falcon, the aviary there, wasn't it? Yeah. Falcon and
something like that, some bird related title. I had a cocktail with him at a conference. He's a pretty interesting guy to talk to, and he's friendly, but
yeah,
I don't know, man. Counterintelligence and anyone who comes from the world of kind of like disinformation ops and stirring the pot, I have a trouble, you know, believing entirely.
I do too, especially, you know, the people I like is when you know, whistleblowers, like real whistleblower, like Ted Gunderson from the FBI, for example. Are you familiar with Ted Gunderson?
I'm not.
Ted Gunderson's the guy that told Alex Jones about Epstein Island, you know.
That guy.
And Ted Gunderson was, you know, he gives the names of the military contractor, the scientists involved, and, you know, those are the details that you need as whistleblowers to really blow the lid off programs. And because at me as a researcher, if you're like Jeremy Corbell and you're like, oh, I have classified sources and I can't tell you, but I heard this, this, and this, and there's no scientific intel, there's no meat and potatoes for a term that I can go look up now, like spatiotemporal optical vortices or magnetohydrodynamics. There's no thing that I can go and look up to go find out, well, who wrote about this in Google Scholar, and is you can't find the scientists, contractors, you know, that it's not a real black op, it's not a real SA special access program. It's not, you're not digging up real secrets and not finding real information. You know, for example, I was able to confirm that there was something to this terahertz stuff, because one day I found a contractor that had been arrested. And this is an interesting case, because when the contractor was arrested, this guy was a researcher at a university. And the original newspaper article story claimed that he had been growing marijuana plants, and that they had sent the DEA there to go and look for a marijuana grow at his residence. But that first story turned out not to be true, and there was no DEA there. It was actually the Air Force OSI, and they weren't there looking for marijuana plants. They were looking for classified documents. But they had told the newspaper that originally, so that that is disinformation, to make a false report. Now, compare that to what Jeremy Corbell did in his film on Bob Lazar, where he spent the first 10 or 15 minutes hyping up that FBI raid, okay? Saying that the FBI raid on United Nuclear was for Element 115 and looking for Bob's Element 115. When in fact, we later find out from the FBI that there was only FBI there. There was no Atomic Energy Commission people there. There was no nuclear squads there. It was only FBI, and they were looking for thallium because United Nuclear sells, of all things, thallium, which someone uses.
See, like, I think that makes sense to me, but a few people would definitely argue, well, actually, that could be the cover story, right? That we wanted to go see the thallium, yeah, but actually we're looking for the 115, just like the other Air Force story.
The thing is that Jeremy Corbell never proved that, and he never got the warrant. Because we found the war, we other researchers, I think it was Steve Cambion of Truth Seekers that went and got the actual police report and the warrant and everything. And Corbell didn't do that. It's not real investigation. It's poor journalism. It's just over dramatized, because if there was evidence for that, he should have presented it. And otherwise, why even mention it or waste people's time on it? I mean, it's just... but anyways, back to the other contractor that I found in Fairborn, Ohio. He ended up doing a year in a federal prison for bringing documents home. And it turns out that he did his PhD thesis on terahertz technology and was working for the ultra-fast photonics and terahertz research group there at the university. So it proves that there is classified Air Force intelligence work being done into terahertz wave technologies.
Well, this is something that I wanted to talk to you about, is the whole LK-99 superconductor, because I think this is a pretty interesting situation, and I know that you guys have been working on essentially like their models trying to replicate things. But could you give people a bit of an idea, because not everyone knows this kind of stuff, can you give people a bit of an idea of why superconductors are important and what their function is, and why something like room temperature superconductivity would be such a big deal?
The first superconductor that was ever discovered was actually mercury. They supercooled mercury and found that it turned superconductive. So that was the first time they discovered superconductivity, is by a scientist by the name of Meissner. And that's who the Meissner effect is named after. So if you were able to create a superconductor, the problem is that you have to keep it super, super cold, and that takes a ton of energy. So the amount of energy that you save, in transmission costs over long distances, you don't get back when you have to pump all that energy in to take the heat out and to super cool it. So there's a certain point where you have an energy trade-off. So if you had something that's superconductive at room temperature that doesn't require you to put all that extra energy into it, it's just naturally superconductive, that's going to be super cost-effective to all our infrastructure. We're going to be able to have lightning-fast communication and power without losses, is basically what you'd have. It would, revolutionize a lot of our infrastructure if you had a room temperature superconductor. Now, they make superconducting wire. They're making 6,000 miles of it currently for the ITAR reactor project over in the fusion reactor. So they need these superconducting wires to make super magnets. Superconducting super magnets can produce really high magnetic fields And you need those super high magnetic fields to get nuclear fusion going. So this is what they're doing currently at ITAR. So if they were able to make those out of something else other than, you know, YCBO, which needs to be cooled to about 70 Kelvin or 170 Kelvin, you could, if you could get something that you didn't have to supercool, it would be a lot more cost effective, and it would also give you power gains and stuff. You know,
so what's the story with it with LK99? What happened here?
So LK99 is an interesting story. What it looks like happened is someone might have published a paper under the scientist's name. I don't think it was actually that. I think one of the scientists came forward and says that they didn't publish this actual paper, and it was a false pre-publication study. So it wasn't a peer-reviewed study. But when it came out, it went sort of viral across the internet because people were like, "Oh, room temperature superconductor, and here's, you know, the ability to replicate it was pretty easy. You could just use, you know, lead oxide and some red phosphorus and a couple, you know, low cost, easy to get reagents." And so groups across the internet started, you know, taking up trying to replicate the results and make some of this stuff. And thanks to a couple hoaxes, I think the excitement grew even wider because a couple of people made fake videos, you know, showing levitation and other things, and those got more interest in the subject. And we had just gotten a vacuum furnace for another project, and so we had all the lab equipment pretty much to do this on hand. So we actually made some lanarkite glass and then baked it up into you know, the LK99, and we got some pieces that looked like they had paramagnetism or diamagnetism. They were acting really funny in a magnetic under the magnetic field in the magnet when we first pulled them out under the microscope, and I put that video out and showed that, you know, this piece here, and then we actually had a piece of an iron filing that was following the magnet around, and you could see the other piece of our LK99 crystal wasn't doing that, but it still wasn't loading, it wasn't, you know, locking and trapping, you know. So we had to we wanted to do some more experiments, so we went and we did an SEM imaging on it, so scanning electron microscope to kind of give a whole elemental background too on what it contains, to see, maybe first thing I wanted to look for was iron impurities, because if you have a little bit of iron impurity inside that chunk of your crystal, it can cause it to act like a paramagnet, you know, like kind of like a compass needle or something. So that might be contamination that's causing that. So we're still waiting to get the full results back from the SEM. It's been a lengthy process. The guy who did it for us was kind of doing it in his spare time, so he's got to like coordinate that between actual work and research projects on that machine. So we're waiting to hear back from him on that. And in the meantime, we've kind of lost interest because the facts that came out about, you know, the original author claiming that wasn't his paper, and that these people had, you know, made up this group, including the address, which another investigator went to that address and found that it's like some basement apartment building in South Korea and not like a real lab and stuff. So
weird.
Yeah, there's been, yeah, it's a weird story. But, you know, then again, you like, we were just, I don't, as a scientist, I'm like, well, let's just read the paper and the results. We're going to try to replicate it as best as we can. And maybe, you know, we're not going to do what some of the other papers did, is they just took that paper, which is translated from South Korean, and replicated it exactly without, you know, using their assumptions on the parts that weren't clear, and just immediately reported their results, you know, like just exactly as is. And that's nothing wrong with that. But we mentioned it, there's might be a little bit of finesse in the formula. Maybe the people who invented this didn't release the whole formula. Maybe there's certain things to make it work better that we could tweak. So we went through a lot of trouble of working with some of the other material scientists in the other groups out there to try to improve on the formula and answer a lot of the questions, you know, that guys like, what's his name, that was doing a lot of the replications. I forget his name, the guy who was doing all the replications early on.
But the tests that you were running, were they producing effects that were novel effects he didn't expect, or just byproducts that weren't that interesting?
A couple of those samples that showed the paramagnetism and showed a little bit of weird magnetic effects. So there is that. There is some paramagnetic pieces that is covered in this. And I think that might have confused or threw some research groups off. But we haven't been able to grow a big enough crystal. For one, we have a facility. I can't run that vacuum furnace at the place we are, our current facility. I can't run it overnight. I have to be there watching it while it's running. So we can only do like an 8 hour run, because I'm not doing more than 8 hours at work. You know, I could maybe do a 12 hour run. But what we wanted really to grow a large crystal is to run a batch for like 4 days. And we can't currently do that where we're at. So there might be other groups working on that. We've got enough information out there about our replications to help other groups with their ability to, you know, improve on that formula. So, hey, if there is a big cover up and someone just made up all that other stuff to discredit it, then we'll know for sure with the science, because you can't, you know, if it works, it works. And if it,
I don't know, it's interesting. I mean, like, do you think innovations like
trust that line of information, though, a lot of people would have hung up their research right there and been like, oh, that's that. Then we don't have to look into this and it's fake. But like, real science isn't about that. It's about trying to get the results. And
right. If you think things like this, room temperature, superconductivity, cold fusion, do you think breakthroughs like that have been suppressed?
If there's an incentive to suppress, then yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's definitely an incentive if they've created it, right? Because it's incredibly powerful technology.
Example in cold fusion, Husienga was one of the top fusion scientists, and he wrote the most damning book that was the, you know, debunk the coup de grace for cold fusion back in the day. And a lot of people have argued that, you know, Husienga had a conflict of interest because, you know, cold fusion posed a threat to all the funding that the hot fusion community was getting. And you know, he actually managed and ran one of the biggest hot fusion labs at the time. And so there was, you know, this argument that, you know, of course he's got, you know, conflict of interest. He's, you know, trying to, it's like the big candle again.
Yeah. I mean, if there was an innovation like that, I'm sure there'd be elements of suppression. Do you think that the I mean, one of my favorite stories, I mean, it's a sad story, obviously, because the guy died, but I always wondered if there was truth to it, which was the Stanley Myers hydrogen fuel cell engine, like the toroidal engine.
How about that? What was the security guard that I covered too? He was working on the same Stanley Meyer, you know, fuel technology.
Right.
Security guard that got shot from that, like, that mass shooting event that people were at. When the hell was that? It was Michael something or other. I covered that guy and I tried to watch some of his videos and get into it. But again, it might have just been a coincidence that, you know, he was into that stuff and got, you know, he was that kind of mentality where he was going to save the world with free energy technology, but he's also going to save all those people from that mass shooter. You know, it takes a certain type of person, you know. I can kind of, but, you know, like, you can tell, like, who's the type of person that's going to stand up for you and like, that kind of situation and really handle business, and who's going to cower down and not, you know, be like, oh, well, you know, let someone else do it, you know, kind of idea. So, yeah, I guess I don't have any information on the water cart technology other than that the Geet engine. And there's a couple other people that have worked on this and developed it. Who was the guys that were at Tesla Tech that I covered last year, not this year, but the year before? There was a group there working on the Geet technology and these apparent ways to, you know, you're electrolyzing water.
Yeah.
Turning it into oxygen and then combusting it again and supposedly getting more energy back than you do from separating it. And but I guess some of the problems are in the actual machines itself. that claim the efficiency losses are due to like a hydrogen leaking out because of improper storage. So that we're going to, you know, graphene lined tubing so that the hydrogen can't escape. And then the, of course, the corrosive of the oxygen and other things on some of the wear and tear on some of the parts in these machines are problems and stuff. But yeah, as far as that goes, we have a laboratory available in New Jersey and up here in Massachusetts, you know, and we'd be happy if you have a technology that violates the second law of thermodynamics and you can prove it. I would love to verify that and look at it. We might try to hold an event like that, like once a year, where we have like a challenge, you know, like an open challenge for people. Of course, there's all kinds of prizes for people that can prove this too that are out there. You know, the anti-gravity prize that was just put out by that guy, Lincoln Labs and stuff. I was talking about it that I covered a couple months ago. But anyways, this if people have that technology, I would love to be the one to help prove that out and expose it. And we have forums for this kind of stuff as well for people that, you know, we have APEC Open Mic where anyone can just get on and share information. And we have a lab facility where we'd love to prove out these things. I mean, I know a guy personally down in Pennsylvania, and he's got a warehouse. Oh God, I wish I could show you this video. Oh God, I don't think I'm allowed to, but he's got a warehouse full of Bedini motors and all these free energy like things that he's built and tried and over the years, and he's just an expert with all that stuff. But nothing, as far as I know, has proven to get, you know, limitless free power from nothing, and there's no like proven violation of the second law. And I would love to see that. And, you know, it's very disappointing law of physics that we can't get energy from nothing and there's no free lunch, I guess. But a lot of these things do work on some ways to harvest energy from environmental sources, you know, because I guess the second law of thermodynamic relies on the assumption that you have a closed system. But in nature, there's really no such thing as a closed system because we're all entangled. And there's always losses or entanglement with other things, in any sort of situation. So, the idea is that maybe we can harvest energy from ambient sources or...
Well, that's why, I mean, like, obviously the technological capabilities needed to do it is a different question, but do you think it's feasible to pull energy out of the ambient quantum vacuum and that could be the infinite source of energy?
So there might be a way to do it, right? And it would have to be in quantum mechanics and quasi-particles and sort of these interactions. A lot of these 2D membranes have physical environments that are not well documented and not well understood by the current literature. And I think if it exists somewhere in there. You look at guys like Daniel Sheen, Professor Daniel Sheen. He's working on a bipolar membrane device, which creates a pH gradient across it, and he's getting energy from it. And we have we were actually working on that project at our lab currently, and we're going to be doing like a Hackaday prize contest for that project as well, which I'm going to help out with the video on that for. But yeah, there's a lot of people working on these ideas, and with, you know, good physics and good ideas for how to do this. But as far as you know, using this as energy sources, there's tons of energy sources all around us. So like cold fusion, for example, there's enough there's more power in a cup of there's enough power and energy in a cup of seawater to boil all the world's oceans if you were to have the fusion energy and turn that mass into energy through E=mc², right? So you could boil all the oceans of the world and just the energy inside one cup of water. But accessing that and figuring out how to do it and how to release that is another problem, because it's like, again, it's deeper physics that we still have to, as advanced as we think we are right now and as much as we think we know, I think we're only at the start of where we're going.
Well, I mean, that's the stuff we have to. You have to wonder. You know, have they done it in the black with trillions of dollars of black money and a lot of time on their hands, or are they just grappling with it quietly and wasting a lot of money while they do it?
Well, we know that SPAWAR and the U.S. Navy labs did a lot of cold fusion research, and they actually were able to confirm cold fusion. They showed tritium samples in their results, and I actually got to meet Larry Forsley at MIT when he came in 2014, and he was a scientist who worked on that project. That was interesting. I didn't really get to sit down directly and talk with him, but I was like with a big group of people afterwards out to dinner where I got to sit and listen to him, you know, argue with a bunch of the people that actually knew they were talking about. So,
do you have any, you got any hope for a presidential candidate that might actually handle this issue? The UFO issue, the corporate cover up issue, anyone that's in your sights?
RFK Jr. is the only one right now that I see having any chance of, you know, getting to the bottom of any of this, and only because he's raised the issue about his uncle and his father's murders, which, as we talked about earlier, are directly connected to the UFO file. If he digs into that, he's going to get some information out. And
yeah, and I saw you put up a tweet about him, actually. Do you think he's got a chance?
It's hard to say with the control that they have over the media. You know, I talked to my dad. I was like, oh, what do you think about RFK? And he's like, that guy's a complete idiot. You know, and I was like, oh, well, you know, they did like a 4-hour interview with him and chopped up about, you know, 1 minute worth of material.
Right. The way it worked.
It's going to be a difficult puzzle, but if he could go after the deep state, you know, the people that killed his father and his uncle, and we can oust those people and bring them out, that's best chance of bringing the UFO file out and getting to the bottom of all this that we ever have. I mean, I don't know, unless anyone's got any better ideas or a plan B, you know. It's a crazy system. I don't know if we'll be able to vote our way out of all the problems.
I don't think so.
It's, I don't know if government is the ultimate answer or solution to our problems.
Well, so much of it's corporate now. So much of it's corporate control, you know.
I think, JFK had it right when he said, you know, don't ask what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. And, you know, it's really about us stepping up to do something for our country. And I hope that, you know, my work with alien scientists has, you know, brought a lot of this disclosure along further, because opening up, you know, the scientific side of this, opening up a lot of that information, giving people access to the scientists and the information, and giving a platform for that to be done. And I think that's my contribution anyway towards disclosure and towards, you know, the future, because we need to figure out what works, you know, to teach people science, but also teach the new generation and young next generation that, you know, you can be interested in science, because it's not just all boring crap. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that you have to learn, but look at all the cool stuff that you'll be able to do with it, you know, once you, you know, struggle through your high school stoichiometry, chemistry homework that may seem like it's pointless and boring right now. But in the future, when you want to make, you know, graphitic carbon nitrate, or, you know, some of these other things, you know, hexagonal boron nitrate, or some of these other things you're going to need to build UFOs or whatever you want to build in the future, you're going to damn wish you paid attention and had that knowledge. So I think it's a good place for, you know, Americans to realize that, you know, we're at a turning point in our evolution and our history, and we got our hands on the, since the Cold War, we have our, you know, a finger right on the button, you know, imminent global self-destruction at any moment in time. We could work together to build, you know, incredible things and make sure that the human race doesn't ever end, because, you know, all, right now all our eggs in one basket. All it takes is one asteroid to wipe out this one planet that we, and that's the human race isn't anywhere else. We don't have a Mars base. We don't have a moon base. We don't have any space stations that, you know, we can live on long term and really get off. You know, we'd be done. So this is our home. We need to take care of it. And we need to really plan for the future and, you know, think outside of this sort of banker mentality where our only goal is profits and money and, you know, strategic conquests and objectives, you know, control of resources. You know, why are we fighting over resources on this planet when we could be mining asteroids and there's just infinite resources in space? We get massive solar panels set up. You know, we could have energy generation and a Z machine. We could make pretty much anything that we wanted, just with the amount of energy that we had and the elements and materials available in space.